Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom. And we are doctors of physical therapy bringing you the body tips and PT pearls to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in.
All right, and diving quick into another listener review. This one's from Lynn Shute saying, love this podcast. So as someone who has gotten very curious about health, wellness, and the body recently, this podcast is so great. It's super interesting, and Doc Jen and Dr. Dom make everything so open and accessible. Thank you for sharing your insight with us. We love that. I love those words, open and accessible. We're trying to bring the information to you in a way that helps you find your optimal body. So Lynn, if you want to reach out to us at jen@docgenfit.com, we have a free month of the Optimal Body membership for you. And for anyone listening out there, we're only doing this for 2 more weeks. So if you get on, give us a review, leave us an honest review telling us what you love and what you want to learn more about, and we'll be giving away a free month of the Optimal Body membership for the next 2 episodes. So get in and leave us that review. All right, so welcome back to another PT Pearl. This time we're going to be talking about meniscus and meniscal injury of the knee. So what is the meniscus? Should I dive right in?
Yeah.
So the menisci are these two little C-shaped or moon-shaped pads in the knee, basically, that offer a lot of the cushioning for the impact that goes through those knees. And it just offers a lot of surface area. They're a super complex tissue with all these different layers, and they're very hydrated, especially earlier in life. But they take a lot of pressure. So different people, for different reasons, of course, will get injury. And the thing about these pads is they have vascularization, meaning that they just get blood flow only kind of on the outer bits of them, and the insides don't get a ton of vascularization, so blood flow or nerve input. So it's just very variable as to what we do with them when people have injuries, or if there are tears, what kind of tear it is, what layer of the meniscus it's in, how are we going to deal with that. So we're not going to dive too much into like the research and stuff of this. We're more so going to talk about things that we can do to help optimize the way the knees might be feeling.
Exactly. Because especially with that, talking vascular, avascular, again, meaning just that blood flow, there's a portion of the meniscus that can heal itself. But even with a portion that can't quite heal itself, doesn't necessarily mean that you run to surgery first. Our first recommendation is always, as we're physical therapists, is usually getting conservative treatment first. So working through some of the issues that we're going to be talking about, of some of the exercises that you should be thinking about that can help to support and offload the knee. Now, of course, if you are in injury and pain right now, please go see a medical doctor. We are not your medical doctors. We are not here to tell you exactly your treatment plan for your knee. We are here to provide what we believe, you know, can help support someone to either avoid having this knee injury in the first place and just help you to understand how it's working in the body and how that could be caused. Because that's the other thing. Like, just because you're going to have surgery doesn't mean that it's going to fix whatever led to that positioning anyways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's reasons we put more pressure through the knees, and that can be because of a multitude of different things. So aren't there are certain populations that this does happen more in than others though, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, especially if we're talking degenerative meniscal injury. So that usually comes, it's degenerative, as is most things in our body, you know, or later on in life. So meaning 60s and above, usually you're going to see this coming up on imaging more often than not. Even if you don't have symptoms or pain or anything happening in the knee, you might have degenerative changes on the image. And this also usually goes in conjunction with osteoarthritis in the knee as you get older, again, above 60, and these different changes that are happening.
Yeah. And the other kind of group that will have these more often than others is athletes or people in that, you know, younger age range that are just doing a lot of impact to the knees, that have more of a traumatic injury because they pushed their body to a position that they weren't comfortable in, they weren't mm-hmm. safe in, and they couldn't control in. And then we have traumatic injury, which is something that I had happen to me.
Yes.
And that, again, we're going to talk into some of the restrictions that I've been working on as we talk into how to progress your body into understanding why you're putting more pressure through those knees. But, you know, I was playing football all throughout college and I never quite injured myself on the field. And then, of course, when I'm messing around with my buddy on the snow, we're like shoving around and my foot slipped and caught into a dry patch and twisted. And the next morning I wake up and my knee's all swollen because I remember it happened and I kind of went down, but I got back up nice and quick because we're just messing around and noticed something was wrong with my knee, but it was nice and swollen for about a month. And I was honestly still doing all sorts of activity and stuff. Finally went into the doctor's office and he comes back in after the image or the MRI and he says, "Oh my gosh, this is like a really bad bucket handle tear," and blah, blah, blah. And he was shocked that I could still even like move my knee through the full range. So I had 1 year of football left. I'm like, "Take it out, doc. I got to play football." And had a meniscus surgery on one side. And then turns out in PT school, I was trying to offload my knees by doing a little swimming and doing a really hard whip kick or frog kick in the pool. Of course, I get out of the pool after that and I had the same exact feeling in my left knee. And I'm just like, what the heck? Like, I'm trying to do this to take pressure off my knees. And I tore my left meniscus, or I never had an image of it, but all of my PT professors started to do tests on it. They're like, "Yeah, you probably tore your medial meniscus of your left knee." But the complete difference in how they approach it was just like, "You're fine. Like, you still have good strength. You still have good, mm-hmm. you know, range of motion at your knee. We've gone over this already. You know what to do for this." Mm-hmm. And so that was so empowering to me.
Oh my God. Yeah. Instead of saying, "Oh my gosh, this is so horrible. You're going to have surgery." And I love that that's how they really prepped it in your mind. And I wish that we would focus, you know, I wish that your original doctor would have focused more on like, "Oh, look, you have full range of motion.
Yeah.
You've been playing on this already. Let's try to send you to therapy first before we initially do the cleanup," which honestly, a cleanup is arthroscopic. It's not terrible.
Yeah.
To go in and kind of clean something up. You're up and you're walking the next day and it's not a invasive surgery or anything, but it's still like, what are the measures that we can take now, you know, to maybe prevent surgery or mm-hmm. not be so afraid of it. And that's really what we want to start to guide into based on these exercises we're going to talk about, that you can just start to think about your body in a different way, hopefully.
Totally. So, I mean, because a lot of them are the restrictions I have, why don't we just dive right in?
Yeah.
I know that you talk a lot about your neighbors. And if you have neighbors that aren't, you know, great, the knee is going to take a lot more pressure. So those yes. neighbors being the ankle and the hip. If we have limitation in mobility at the ankle and hip, we likely are going to compensate through the knee.
Yeah. The knee just becomes victim because it's overworking now for what's not working well at the ankle and at the hip. And so, especially at the ankle, when we're talking about the restriction, you're probably more looking at, because meniscal injury happens more with kneeling and squatting and going down into that deep squat position. We're especially degenerative. That's like, you know, working overtime in that squatting position. If you don't have good ankle dorsiflexion, meaning that the ankle is coming up, or the top of the foot is coming up toward the shin, that is ankle dorsiflexion. And one of the ways that you could just test this, if you go all the way down to the ground and you kind of put your, and you just like, how can I, like, small kneel? It's not half kneel.
You have 1 foot on the ground and you're kneeling down on the other one.
Yeah. And you just try to see, like, can I even lean my knee over my toe? If your knee does not go past your toe without your heel lifting up, you probably have a restriction in your ankle.
Absolutely. And that's one thing that I work on every day, along with hip mobility.
Yes.
If our hips aren't able to rotate well, and if our hips aren't able to then control through that rotation, we might tend to compensate by, well, first of all, with the foot, we might tend to compensate for lack of dorsiflexion by rotating our feet out.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's a problem. And that's something I did all throughout college, where then my knees would, even if I would rotate my hips out as far as I could, my knees would still fall kind of inside my toes when I would do heavy squats and things like that. So I was just kind of setting myself up for it.
But that is so common, like yeah. that I see all the time. And it almost makes me cringe sometimes because it's just a lack of awareness. It's just like, oh, I don't even realize that my feet are so wide. I've been told I should put my feet out even wider if I don't have good hip mobility, right? But what happens if you turn your feet out or you make them so wide that your hips cannot follow the upper legs mm-hmm. that connect into your hips cannot follow, the knee ends up going on the inside of that toe. And it's just that that rotation and that torque over and over again could potentially, we're not saying it is, yeah. but it could potentially lead to some torque and discomfort at that knee joint.
Yeah. And so from the ankle, then we go up to the hip, and a place that a lot of people don't explore a ton is their mobility into rotation, right? Or they're more so great at rotating in one direction and not the other. So yeah, one of Jen's favorites, and this has become one of my favorites, is the 90-90, if I can fit on this table. The 90-90, where you kind of sit with 90s, and we've gone over this before, and you can test both your internal rotation by sitting back into that hip, and then leaning forward to kind of test the external rotation at either of those hips as well.
Yeah, and we've shown this a million times. So if you just scroll Instagram or YouTube at Dr. Unfit or Dr. Dom DPT, you will find these, I promise yeah. you. And it's just a really easy way to start to explore the hip in this rotation because, again, you need rotation in the hip if you want better flexion. It's just better squatting, I should say. It just goes hand in hand. Okay, so then what do we do after we open up mobility?
So I would say, how much is your knee actively moving in the different ranges and the different planes that the knee can move? So our knee moves both in flexion and extension and also in rotation. And there's easy ways to kind of actively just see, okay, how much can I extend that knee actively or straighten that knee actively? And how much can I flex that knee actively or bend it actively without pain or without approaching any of that discomfort?
Exactly. And that's like, can you do it laying on your back? Can you do it laying on your stomach? Can you do it standing? How much can you bend that knee up into your bottom, that heel to your bottom? And sometimes it's not just an active like hamstring thing. It's also a mobility in the quad. Remember, like if you're getting trouble like pulling that leg into its full range of motion, don't just look at how much strength you need into that range, but look at what could be restricting it on the other side. And that's the quad, that top of the thigh, that could be really restrictive and adding a lot of pressure into that knee as well.
Totally. And then we have the tibial rotation, which is a tough thing to explain over a podcast, of course, but just that's one of the things that it's those twisting injuries that are, or the twisting mechanism that is where a lot of these meniscal injuries happen. So if you can get used to rotating that tibia actively, isolating what you're doing with your thigh and getting used to rotating that lower part of your leg.
Yeah, the lower leg. Tibia yeah. is the lower part of the leg underneath the knee.
Totally. And then just exploring that. How much can you rotate it? How much can you rotate it the other way? It's kind of shocking how little we can actively move that, but when you put a little bit of attention into it, you can get some progression there.
Yeah. So that's what we have to realize, is that a leg doesn't just bend and extend. It actually does have a little bit of rotation. And when we just start to get that brain and the body connection used to that rotating, mm-hmm. then it's when we can start to move it into standing and totally. Do some different ranges standing, which we're not going to necessarily show through the podcast right now. But this is just a way of being able to explain again, like we can't just look at, oh, I just need to strengthen my hip.
Yeah.
Or I just need to put more stretching on my knee. Like, it is not just one thing. It could be a multitude of things. It could be what's happening at the foot. It could be what's happening at the hip. And that's why when you say, what do I do for my meniscus? It's not always the best question.
Yeah. Usually the question to ask is, why am I putting that extra pressure through the meniscus? Mm. And I think some of the things we've gone through already can help point out to just the average person, oh, okay, I'm limited here and I've been compensating through the knee. And that's a tough thing, especially for me who was a college athlete, like to admit, like, man, I really just need to come back to some of this basic stuff. And yes. hip stabilization exercises are great.
Totally.
Especially if, you know, that's where we need to start, just getting those hips used to activating through that range, then coming to standing and working into some different squats versus hinges. And when mm-hmm. we're loading more into the hip through a hinge pattern, versus putting a little more pressure through the knee in a
Squat pattern.
So that just means, like, again, almost like think of a deadlift. That's where that hip hinge that you might have seen, like where someone puts a stick or a dowel behind their head and they want to keep it touching, you know, all
touching
the way
their whole, back.
The back into the pelvis, into the top of the head, and then moving in a straight line. Can I bend from my hips and stand back up without rounding through my spine and without having to bend a ton into my knees? And when you can do that, that's where you really start to own that access point, which is our hips. And that's what I always say, like our hips are our access point. This is where we need to move from the upper body to the lower body. And that's why our hips become so powerful. And so that's, again, you know, learning all these strengthening exercises and hip hinging patterns in standing becomes so valuable. But that's where we don't just want to do posterior chain, meaning the back of the body, hip hinging, deadlifting, squatting, where we're only filling our glutes. Here's the other thing that I hear a lot that I just got to put in there is that people say glute amnesia, right? My glutes have turned off. They're no longer awake. If you can stand, if you can walk, your glutes are not shut off. Okay.
Yeah. Maybe otherwise you'd fall straight forward.
You would fall completely to the ground. So it's not that you have complete amnesia within those glutes. Don't be so afraid that, like, oh, it's not activating at all. And like, I've had a client where she was at a previous clinician where she was just like, I just cannot activate my glutes at all. They just don't turn on. They do turn on. You just might not have that awareness built in right now. And that's what us as clinicians should be helping you with. Not telling you that it's wrong, it's bad, you're not doing it. Just helping you to understand it in your body.
We're all somewhere along that spectrum where we, might not use the glutes currently that much. And if we've been doing that for a long time, it's kind of difficult to wake them up. And that's like Jen said, where a clinician's really going to help with that. And she mentioned when we start with the hip and start in a very hip dominant pattern that keeps the knees in a safe place, which is why it's great for us to kind of start there to learn how to control that knee in a safe position to do those hinging and squatting patterns. And that's when we might want to then move into things that are a little more challenging and demanding on the knees so that we can
also
progress
safe.
From there. Also safe.
Like, I don't want to say that like one thing is safe or not safe. It's just, it unloads the knee when you do a lot of hip stuff. So it becomes, less pressure, so we can decrease the symptoms that you might be having at the knee initially.
Yeah, absolutely. And so then that's where, once we get really used to doing those hip hinging patterns, maybe moving to one leg and getting used to doing things on a single leg, because then that knee is kind of on its own. It doesn't have its other leg to partner and buddy with and be like, hey, you're there to support me. It's okay. We still can work into some of those mini squats. I love a four-way mini squat is one of my favorites to do personally, because it gets me on one leg, reaching a foot out to the side, doing a little bend and tap, reaching a foot out front, doing a little bend and tap, crossing my body, and then going to the back, because it teaches my hip through all those range of motion to keep my knee in a good, safe, comfortable position when I'm on one leg.
Yeah. And then after we learn kind of those patternings and we kind of build up that back chain, we cannot forget about the front chain. Okay. It is not just about, let me just strengthening in the hips and that's going to help my knee completely, because the reality is as you walk downstairs, your knee is going to pass your toe. As you turn and you go and run after your child, your knee is going to rotate in. So it's, how can I then create the strength necessary in my knee to be able to better tolerate these positions? Because we are not preventing injury, but we're making our body more prone to
controlling and feeling safe and having control in those motions when we get put in them in the future. Because again, we like to think that we can always control our environment, but
we can't.
You know, kid runs one way, dog runs the other way, and we twist and we turn. And if we've been training those, and if we've been training ourselves to get into kind of these positions that, again, might be challenging and demanding, but we can safely progress into, and we can create that preparedness in our body to be ready for those when we get presented with them. Again, that's kind of why we're showing you this progression to places that you might think are unsafe, because that's what has been taught to us at this point.
Yes. And that's the whole point of like opening up the language of like, it's not that it's not safe to put your knee forward. It's just that we get to work progressively of how you can in your body safely push it forward without all of a sudden putting so much load and saying, okay, now we're just going to what a common exercise called sissy squat. You can Google that and look it up. Sissy squat. I'm just going to go all the way down to the ground and come back up. No, it takes a progression. Just like anything, just like if I'm going to start squatting, I'm going to progressively add more load. I'm not just going to go pick up a heavy barbell. Hopefully, right? So it's like the same thing with your knees. If I'm going to train my knee how to tolerate more load forward, which I will urge you, do not neglect it. I don't care how old you are. Don't neglect your knee coming forward. It's just that you want to be smart, work with someone if you're unsure of how to pattern it, and start to become comfortable in different positions of that knee going forward, going side, kind of twisting, and creating that whole stability from your foot even up the chain to your hip.
Yeah. And it's all the progression. Again, that's not the first thing you're going to start with. So yeah. If you've done everything in order, that's not going to be something that is as scary once you get to it. It's going to seem like an appropriate challenge for you.
Exactly.
So hopefully all that progression kind of made sense and was easy to follow. It's kind of tough for us to talk through it sometimes. But again, we've shown all of these things on our social medias. Look those up. Google the things we're talking about. And thanks so much for joining us on this PT Pearl.
Yeah.
All right. And heading into our next interview, we are super excited to have Dr. Michael Lau, who's from The Prehab Guys. He's a doctor of physical therapy, and we're so excited to have him on to talk about what he and the other Prehab Guys do.
Yeah, The Prehab Guys, who we're not all going to get to talk to, but Craig Mandel and Arash Mansoundi, they've created a incredible platform online, so you can search more of them on almost any type of social media at The Prehab Guys. And you can look up more about their training programs at theprehabguys.com. We'll link this all up in the show notes, but let's dive in and take a listen to their journey. All right. Well, welcome to the podcast, Michael Lau. I'm so excited to have you representing your boys, The Prehab Guys. And what I really admire about you guys and what you've created and what you've done over the years, which is very kind of mirroring, you know, my journey and everything that I've done. I've just appreciated that you've continued to put out the content, to do the work. And if you guys just go look up Prehab Guys right now, I mean, you heard about them in our intro. And I think what I also believe is so powerful is the way that you guys have continued to not only put the content out there for all of the general population to kind of see and explore, but also you continue to support other people within the community. So whether it's PTs or chiros, I've always seen you guys be very open. You don't tear anyone down. And that's something that I hold of like high value. So I really appreciate what you guys have created and the way that you continue to push it forward.
I really appreciate it. Those are really awesome words. Thank you, Jen. And you know, we really look up to you too and everything that you've done. You know, I feel like we've all, I guess, kind of got started around the same time. I don't even really know. But I feel like it's just been good. Like the more voices we have out there that are pushing the same messaging and the right messaging to people, the better off everyone is going to be, from the healthcare side all the way down to the, you know, the individuals at home that are listening to this podcast and trying to learn a little bit more about their body and their optimal body. So education is the key to all of that. So thank you as well.
Yeah, no. And we, again, I'm newer in this space of content, you know, creation and at least putting stuff out there. And as a young clinician, it's kind of like intimidating to start putting things out there. I want to hear a little bit about, you just mentioned when you got started, you know, prehab. Yeah, us in PT, we love when people talk about prehab. Just talk to us a little bit about starting that up and how you guys approach people getting into this concept of prehab.
Yeah, so I guess back the creation story, I guess you'll say, is we were actually all students in school. We all went to USC together. That's how we all met. That's where we got our doctorates. And in the curriculum, we were all really into orthopedics and sports medicine. The curriculum that year in the program went away from that for a year. It's just kind of how the curriculum went. So we said, hey, we need a way to stay on top of the research. We need a way to keep educating ourselves. And we're tossing around all these ideas. We're like, well, we're already going to, you know, educate ourselves, why don't we just like educate others at the same time? We might as well. We're already doing all the reading. We're already doing all the writing. We're doing, you know, all those things that, to each other to help each other learn. Let's just put it out there for free and online. So we started posting it online. It was also one of those things. It was like, just because, you know, you don't have a six pack abs, I just feel like you have a six pack abs and everyone's going to listen to what you're saying. But we were like, no, like, let's actually put some stuff out there that has research behind it, that has evidence behind it, and give people the power. I think that's the biggest thing as a provider. I want my patients to always feel like they are in control and I'm just their cheerleader and their coach. I'm not the one telling them what to do. They're telling me what they want to do. And I'm, you know, following, I'm right on the side of them. And with the online stuff, it's very, you know, it goes to that. No one's relying on you for anything. It's people online reading, getting educated, and then because they're educated, making better decisions, healthcare decisions for themselves. But unless you don't know that there's something out there, you can't make an informed decision. And that's a big pitfall of healthcare as a whole, but we don't have to dive into that too much unless you guys want to.
Yeah. I mean, you're speaking our language in obviously in how you're saying that and how you're putting it out. I think the hardest thing, though, in putting education out online is that then everyone just starts looking for all of the answers online, right? And like scrolling through Instagram. And I think that's why I could probably speak to it, why you guys have created what you've created, you know, in terms of more programming and specifics for people to dive into. But how do you kind of navigate that in the world when people just want the fix for that exact symptom that they're feeling and they want Instagram to be able to give them all their answers? How do you guys kind of navigate that world?
Yeah, I mean, I think we navigate it the same way that when I was a student and I asked a professor a question and they said, quote, it depends. That's basically how we're answering it. And, you know, there's no easy answer. I think when it comes to educating people that are just looking for fixes, is letting them know that, hey, there is no quick fix. No matter what anyone's telling you, no matter what anyone is selling you, you know, there is no quick fix. And we're totally fine saying that because we're not here to fix people. We're not here to, you know, sell them on anything that they need to buy that's going to cure their pain. You know, we're here to educate them, and whether they want the education or not is up to, you know, the consumer to decide. And our goal is really just to educate people so that they can make better decisions. And those decisions could be choosing surgery versus not surgery. It could be choosing this exercise over that exercise. And I think one thing I've learned the more I've learned clinically as a clinician is that, you know, I really do believe that 75 to 80% of the movements we choose, we as clinicians, we like to think that we're being very specific and we're choosing the best thing and that it needs to be a certain way and the volume needs to be this and all these things. And that definitely matters for, you know, maybe if someone's super acute or the high performance athlete. But for everyone else in between, you know, just getting people moving is going to help them. And then especially working on the psychological side of things, that's going to help people way more than us arguing over what's the best way to do it. So as long as we're telling people that, hey, you know, that pain you have is okay. It's very normal. I wouldn't expect you to ever not be pain-free. And hey, we just got to get you moving and feel positive about it and feel good about it. I guarantee 80% of the people are going to get better just with that messaging and having, you know, a plan, whatever it may be. And there's, you know, thousands of different routes that the plan could be. But as long as they're following something that they feel confident in and they're moving, they're going to get better. You know, the majority of people are going to feel better. I don't know if that answered the question, but just trying to give people hope, I think, is the biggest thing. Is there's so many people that, kind of what you said, they're reading all these things that are just negative. They're not movement optimists, you know, and it gets people scared to do things and they spiral. And most of the people that you'll see in the clinic are spiraling because of the horrible things that they've been told, not necessarily because of what they're actually feeling in their body, if that makes sense, or what happened to them. It's the psychological side. Yeah, so trying our best to combat that one step at a time, one post at a time, I guess you can say.
Yeah, amen. We love that message 100%, can get behind that. And the fact that that's what you guys are mainly pushing, you know, move. It doesn't have to be so complicated. And that's really why, you know, I'm sure why you guys have your podcast, why we started our podcast, because we're just trying to get this messaging out there even more in ways that people can digest it, where it doesn't have to be so complicated. Mm-hmm. You know, no one's going to remember the complicated stuff. They're going to remember, how can I just start to basically get back into my body and feel comfortable to move again. So I love that that's the main message that you guys are pushing, and it's showing, because obviously it's growing and people are loving it and getting involved. So I think that's incredible.
Yeah. And I find that, again, being early in this space and admiring a lot of people like you guys and Jen that are doing it in a way that I can really get behind, I think that you really draw in the type of people based on the way you put that information out. And there's a lot of people out there that are kind of playing that game like you were talking about, like, oh, it's this way or that way. And as a young clinician, I'm realizing more and more, another thing that you just said, the classic PT answer, it always depends. It almost always depends on some other specifics of the scenario. Like, somebody out of context can try to start talking about any specific case, but until you're in the room with that person and start paying attention to them, it doesn't really matter. And your specific skills and specific information hold no water until you get in front of that person. And like you said, meet them where they're at. I tell a lot of people, I'm not a great PT. I'm just a good person. And I feel like I get a lot of people better just by speaking a good message into them. So again, a little tangent, but I really appreciate that. Going to some of those people. So if anyone out there is watching, and again, we're talking about this concept of prehab, which us as PTs were pretty well schooled and how to approach that for ourselves. Mm-hmm. So someone, they're not having pain, right? We generally don't address things until you get pain. Mm-hmm. How can somebody start to do this prehab thing before they even have pains? And that, again, is a it depends answer, but do you have any sort of ideas for us?
Yeah. So I guess it's first identifying what are the things that are important to you in life, from a physical, more from a physical mindset, but also from a couple other angles. But say that someone's a runner, running is super important to them. We already know what are the most common injuries in runners. We already know what the most common modifiable risk factors are for runners. And guess what? Those things also happen to be the same thing that we as clinicians do when people are in pain for rehab. So all those same principles that we apply to rehab to get people out of pain, to get people stronger and functioning better, those are the same things that people can take in a preventative approach to, I guess you can say, bulletproof themselves to decrease the risk of injury. We can't ever say we're going to prevent injury. That would be, you know, mind-boggling to say. If we did, you'd have a $100 billion solution to the world. But we can definitely decrease the risk of things when we know that there are things like modifiable risk factors that we can decrease. So say you have a runner. Okay, are they educated on load management, on their mileage? Do they have a running coach, or have they been reading blogs and figuring that out? Okay, you have a runner. Do they have the proximal strength at their hip and their core? Do they have the proper Achilles stiffness to prevent things like Achilles tendinopathies that you're going to see later on in life, depending on how old the person is? And again, the volume and the amount of time that you devote to prehab does not have to be the same as rehab. In the sense of rehab may have to be, okay, I'm doing these exercises every day for 5 minutes or whatever it may be. Prehab could be a lot less than that because you already are healthy and you're taking a preventative approach to it. So it's doing those little things like that on a day-to-day basis and then keeping them as part of your kind of your everyday routine, like mindfulness for some people. Like, that's the mental side. Okay, yeah, I'm not feeling like I'm stressed, but I'm going to do mindfulness to keep me sane, you know, keep me moving. The same way I may feel like, oh, I need to stretch or whatever it is. You know, it's finding whatever it is for you that's important to you and keeping yourself doing that activity. So trying to figure out what those barriers could be down the road and then trying to adjust them before.
Yeah, I love that. Do you have kind of like a principal guideline that you kind of say, well, in general, when we're talking about prehabbing the body, this is where I like people to start. This is kind of where our programs like to feed into.
Yeah, I think, you can also say that prehab is honestly just really smart training. And I think that's the easiest way to think of it. If someone has a training background and training experience, prehab smart training. Okay, if I'm a runner, what are the exercises I'm going to choose that are going to better address my lower extremity to handle the demands of running than, say, someone who's an Olympic weightlifter? You know, their lifting may be different. Their training may be different. So it goes back to what the person's physical goals may be, and then trying to actually just incorporate those things into someone's training or just movement, whatever their movements that they like to do, incorporating that into their kind of day-to-day movement life.
So say someone has had pain and then they somehow got out of it, whether they went to see someone or just waited it off. And then the back pain comes back and then it goes away, you know, and they kind of have this yo-yo effect with back pain, because I see that happening super common. Would you say this is now more of a rehab problem, or can they prehab it between those areas? And how does someone approach that if they're not like, okay, running isn't specifically my goal, but living without back pain is. So how can I prevent this from continuing to be a pattern in my life?
That's a hard one. I guess the first thing that I say, because I am someone that has recurrent back pain, is that to be okay, and it's hard to tell that to people that are in pain currently, but be okay with it. Just be okay with the notion that this will come back at some point. Can you learn better strategies to continue to move and pick up your kids, get in the car, get off the toilet when an occurrence happens again? Yes. Can you be more mentally prepared to handle the discomfort or pain that may happen when it comes again? Yes. Can you be more physically fit next time, so that way your body's just in a better shape to handle it? Yes. But it goes back to the whole prehab. We can't prevent these things from happening. I think we can surely decrease how often they happen and the severity of them. And kind of accepting that, I know for me and other people, helps a lot. So there are things that you can do to make it way better. Like, I used to have radiating pain down my leg with, oh, it's always been deadlifting all five times. and the first episode lasted 6 months. The first time I had it, this was in college. Second episode was 4 months. Third episode was 3 months. The last two have been a month or less, because I've gotten better. And granted, yeah, now I'm a PT, so I've learned a lot more about how to manage it. And I think that even the psychological side of it is knowing now I have a plan when it happens. I know what to do now when it happens, and I'm okay that it's going to be there. You know, I don't want to say accepting that you're going to be in pain forever, because that's not the right message, but accepting that you have a plan to tackle it when it comes makes you feel more confident. Having a plan for everything is huge. Yeah, sorry if I went off.
No, we would love that.
That's perfect. And I mean, we have been throwing you some really tricky curveballs, because as all clinicians know, when we ask specifically about, oh, how do you prehab anybody, or how do you do this with runners or people with back pain? Again, you're giving really amazing general answers about how people can be that own intuitive, you know, thinker, and what are my goals? What are the things that bring it about? So I'm hearing a little bit that we need to just be intuitive consumers of our own movement, of our own discomforts, of our own pains, and how we progress through that. And what I want to ask you a little bit about, I'll throw you more of a softball, because it's going to be specifically about you, your back pain journey. You mentioned, okay, it started getting less and less and less. What are some of the specific things, like if you just want to talk about your specific journey, like, hey, these are the things that I knew I needed to do. Mm-hmm. Once I got better, I still did them this often. And did you see anybody else along that journey to kind of help you be like, hey, here's what, from the outside point of view, I think you might need to do?
Yeah. I know for me, I did not. In college, I didn't even know physical therapists were a thing, perfectly honest. I didn't do anything. I just didn't work out for 6 months. Probably the worst thing ever that you can do. I just had radiating pain. Not really sure. The second time I had it, I was actually a PT aide. So the therapist there helped me a little bit. And understanding maybe what's going on. Was it a disc herniation? Probably. Was it irritating a nerve root? Probably. And then later, as I got more and more knowledgeable, learning that, okay, I need to find ways to stay moving, even if it means I can't be lifting in the gym anymore. Because going to the gym for me is like my escape. That's not just my physical escape, but my mental escape. And like, if I don't have the gym, I'm not the same person. Like when I have a calendar and I book out things, like my gym is in there. Like I need to know that I'm working out, and I'm not even dead set on a program. I don't even program for myself anymore. I get there and I just do whatever I feel like I want to do. Because again, my goals are my mental and physical health, not necessarily getting bigger arms anymore or snatching heavier weight. That used to be my goals. It's not really anymore. So just knowing that I can find movements and exercises that I can do, even with the discomfort, is very empowering, because I know I'm still going to the gym. Even though my workout may change, I'm okay with that, and knowing that I'm just doing, okay, I'm going to do the elliptical. I never do the elliptical. My back hurts. I'm on that machine a ton. And granted, knock on wood, it's been over like a year and a half, but you know, I do a ton of elliptical stuff. I now have a really easy warm up. It's like 5 minutes. I do that. I used to do it only before deadlifting days, after the second to last episode, but now that's my warm up for everything. It's probably less than 5 minutes. It's basically like some cat camels, some adductor rock backs, a quick hamstring, which is probably more nervy stretch, and then a hip flexor stretch, and then a world's greatest stretch with some downward dogs for like more like nerve mobilization. And it takes me 5 minutes. My heart rate is pumping, my tissues are warm, and I feel good to go. Even when I'm lifting arms, I do that because I just feel good. And that's kind of where it's like, that's what I've identified for me, because many of those things helped me when I was rehabbing. Like the cat camel, that really helped me when I was rehabbing. So I'm taking those things that I used to do in rehab and I made them as part of my quote prehab. That's now my gym warm-up. Even if I'm not feeling any discomfort, that's just what I do now. And then of course, if I'm squatting that day, I have other things I'm going to do to prepare myself to squat. But like, that's always what I start off with, no matter what I'm doing in the gym. So for people that have gone through rehab, everyone can say, if you've gone through rehab, oh yeah, I liked that exercise. That exercise really helped for me. Well, boom, now you have your prehab. That is the thing that you should be taking to your grave with you. And that's the thing that you can be doing on a day-to-day basis. A, you already know it feels good. You've had positive feedback with that in the past that it's worked for you. And we can talk, you know, many reasons why we think things work, or, you know, that's in a different conversation, but whatever, you believe it's worked for you. And that's something that's easy for you to do, you know, wherever, at home, at the office, at the gym. And again, it's empowering you. Now you have a plan. You're in control. You're doing something preventatively, not waiting for something to happen to you.
Yeah, I think this is such an important message. And I want to acknowledge you for being open. And, you know, because it's kind of a vulnerable place for a clinician to be like, yeah, I get pain on and off. And this is a real journey. And I think people need to hear that more, that we're not indestructible. Just because we have some answers that can help guide people doesn't mean that we're not human. And it doesn't happen to us too. And so I just really, I thank you for being so open with your journey so that people can understand this and relate to it in a way that just because you have some tools doesn't mean that you're indestructible. It means that you get to be in integrity and actually use them.
Yeah. No, and I think one of the biggest points that people can take away right there is your rehab routine is your prehab routine. Mm-hmm. Once you are done rehabbing, especially those ones, like you said, oh, hey, that exercise, I felt some real benefit from that. Great. Why don't we do that every day for the rest of your life? You know, or until they find those other exercises to continue mixing in those routines. So yeah, it's so valuable that you yourself, hey, 5 minute routine has helped my flare ups go from 6 months to 1 month and maybe help me maintain managing that a little bit better. So that's
my mom, for example, that we have these prehab programs, which are basically like progressive it's basically progressive exercises and loads that go on for the week, but it's a ton of exercises. Like through an entire 12 week, it's like 100. But again, it's just progressing things. And my mom's doing them right now. And she is like, finally, she's like, okay, I really like these ones, but now it's not on the program anymore. Like, I don't want to, like, I'm doing other stuff, but I like the other stuff. I was like, Mom, the whole goal of these programs is to introduce you to different things that you haven't been exposed to before and find things that you like. And if you're, even if you're only at week 5 of 12 and you already found the three that you like, stop the pro. Like, so I literally told her, I was like, stop doing everything. You found the three that you love, that you say you feel so much better with. And now she's just doing those. And that's kind of like just being exposed and just, and that's where the education, just knowing that there's things out there, whether it be knowledge or movement or whatever it is, find the things that you make you feel better and do more of it. Very simple, like feel good with it. Okay, do more.
Oh yeah, having a little bit of that trust inward to say, hey, they moved me onto these new exercises, but those old ones actually felt better.
Yeah.
I always encourage my patients to be like, why don't you tell that provider that? They're like, oh, they're the doctor. They know. I'm like, no, they don't know how you feel unless you tell them.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate you saying that to say like, hey, we're just the people who have a lot of these tools, but you know how they feel. So once you find those five, take them. You mentioned a little bit about when you had to change your routine up. Like you said, you know, lifting for you was, yeah, your physical hiatus, but it also mentally, emotionally helped keep you balanced in some areas. So when you do need to make a change and when those challenges come up and you can't be lifting, and you mentioned this with clients about, you know, the mental and emotional and psychosocial state, how do you approach that personally when you have those challenges come up, like, hey, I can't lift anymore, this sucks?
So for me, it's trying to be as close to the activity as possible. So even if I can't lift and get under the barbell in the gym, I'm still at the gym doing other things. So I'm still at the gym on the elliptical. I'm still at the gym, maybe doing my cat camels and stretches that I don't need to be at the gym to do that. I didn't have to drive to the gym to do that. Could have done it at home, but I'm in that environment that I love and that I associate with the physical and mental side of things. So, you know, the hardest thing for if you're a runner and you can't run, you're still being involved in all your social running groups. You're still maybe hopefully your running groups have some sort of lifting program. You're still going through that lifting program with your running group. You're still hanging out with your running friends outside of the running environment, going to bars and getting drinks with them. You know, just trying to stay as close to that as possible, even if you have to make modifications. And I think that that advice can apply to just a lot of different things. If we can't do X, Y, Z, we're doing something similar to it within the same environment of it. But just again, trying to mentally stay with it, I guess, even if you physically can't.
Do you guys prescribe any other tools that people should be using at home? You know, typically when people think about physical therapy, they're thinking ultrasound, yeah. Electrical stimulation,
cupping.
Yeah.
All of these.
Graston.
Which aren't bad. We're not like knocking anything. But at the same time, you guys are talking into movement more. So are there any modalities that you recommend people use, or is it mainly just like, listen, move?
So it's always going to be movement and education. Those are going to be our quote, like our weapons, our spears, our first and second spears. But at the end of the day, if someone says that they use cups and it makes their neck feel amazing, I'm going to say, okay, keep using them. I just had a talk about ACLs and bracing. I don't ever tell my patients to wear a brace. And my goal is for them to never need the brace. But if they tell me they feel way more confident cutting and being on the field with a brace, I'm not going to say no, you know, even if there's no evidence to support that bracing is going to decrease risk of an ACL re-injury rate, I'm going to say, sure, go for it. So it's always, again, the person's more important than me, the provider. Like if someone likes those modalities, I'm going to say, you know, do it. But hopefully they're also doing the things that the evidence also supports, the education that I can provide and the movements that I can give them as well. And that's just something else that they can do. And I know like the massage guns and things, they get in such a horrible rap. I have a Theragun. I love my Theragun. And I love it for patients because that is now giving them control. Again, it's all about control. I don't want any patient to ever feel like they don't have control of their own health. Like if you are giving them control by giving them education to make the decisions, or there's a Theragun or whatever it may be modality that they feel like they have control of their body, that's a win for me. Because right now patients don't feel like they have control. People don't feel like they have control. As long as people have control, they can make better decisions and actions to whatever their goals may be. But the control is like, I think my biggest thing. I hate when people feel reliant on others or things for that matter.
Yeah, that's such a great message, because I think there's out in the world right now, especially our world of social media, there's a lot of do this, don't do this, this is dumb, this is, you know, and it's like, it doesn't have to be that black and white. We're not black and white humans. There's a lot of gray. There's a lot of psychology, like you talked about, that goes along with it. And allowing someone to have that be okay is, I think, can open up a lot of people even just listening to this. So thank you for that message.
Yeah, of course. And I hope people, having a plan, having any control is huge, and getting educated, whatever means it may be, but just feel confident in the plan whenever you decide to make that plan, feel confident in it, and then go. I think a lot of people always ask, like, well, how do I know if it's working? How do I know if it's not working? I feel like you'll know if it's not working, but as long as you set a plan and say, okay, I'm going to do this for 8 weeks, commit to it. Don't stop at 4, even if you're not seeing results. Go through the whole 8 week. And then if you don't see results, then okay, then you can tell yourself that I made a plan. I feel confident in that plan. It didn't work. I'm going to make a new plan, and then go with that new plan until you find something that works for you.
And even in that structure, I think it promotes control, because it promotes control that the person was able to stick to something for a certain amount of time and reflect on it. And so absolutely across the board, whether it's with movement or with tools or with a mindset, as long as it helps you feel like you're a little more in control of what's going on in your body, heck yeah. Get after it, and then maybe get with one of us crazy people to tell you a few more things that could help put you back in more control. One of the last questions, Jen and I were kind of looking at you and the other prehab guys. We noticed you guys are all CSCS certified, and you mentioned at the beginning that you
we're more into ortho and, you know, athletic type stuff. Do you think it's important for you guys to have that CSCS certification, or what does that mean to you and your practice?
I wouldn't put any, too much weight, I guess, on the certification itself, but I guess more on the background of understanding that kind of what we mentioned, like prehab, like true prehab is smart training. And training usually involves healthy people on the strength conditioning side, building robustness and capacity. Granted, we should be doing that on the rehab side too, but a lot of times pain's the primary goal for people. So many times we can't get to that stage of building people up. So having an understanding of strength and conditioning principles and understanding what load does to the body and how the body responds to it, I think is super big for anyone in rehab, because the biggest thing, so I teach BFR classes and I always tout this, it's like people get injured and then they drop, their capacity goes down, and then they're in pain. And then we see them on the rehab side, and many times we do an amazing job of getting people out of pain. There are thousands of ways to desensitize people. So we get people out of pain, but then because many patients' goals is just to get out of the pain and we're not connecting those to bigger things, we discharge them and they're done with rehab. So now they're still in this hole, and we didn't do anything to set them up for success for the next time they may expose their tissues to whatever that stimulus is that injured them, or a completely different injury. So we need to be building people up and building their capacity when they're even out of pain, to not only get them back to their baseline, but then to make them even stronger so that we don't see them again in the clinic. I don't ever want to see a patient twice for that reason, but also if I've educated them on how to manage their shoulder, they should know how to manage their knee and their neck and their back, because it's the same. Like we were saying, rehab is very simple. Calm shit down, build it back up. Like, it doesn't matter what the body part is. Yeah, there are thousands of ways to do it. But you got to understand, okay, I just got to take something away, modify temporarily, slowly build more, challenge it even more, and then I'm done. So I would want all my patients to understand that. I really, really try hard. And I'm like, look, you should know how to take care of yourself now for life, no matter what it may be. If you've done this, if we did finish our knee rehab, you should be able to take this to any body region.
It's so many gems that you have been dropping in this, Michael. So I really hope that people are paying attention and listening and feeling relief, to be honest, that it doesn't have to be so complicated. It gets to be a personal journey, and it is just that. It's a journey. It's taking that knowledge, it's building that awareness, and it's creating that capacity within the body over and over and over again. So thank you for your message. Thank you for what you all three are doing out in the world. And to be doing it together, I think that's a cool, cool concept that you guys continue to promote, that we all get to do it together. And it doesn't have to be just one person teaching everything. It's a community. So you guys are the reflection of that. You're the example. So thank you for the work that you do. Where can people find you and get more information from you guys?
Thank you guys for having me on here. So you guys, your audience can find us at theprehabguys.com or on just about every social channel at The Prehab Guys. If people are looking for information on our website, we have this explore or search button, and you can type in it's like a Google, but Google for our website. So you can find just about anything that you're looking for. So that's what I would say for people to look at if they're looking for any sort of information.
Sweet. Amazing. Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you again. Just so much gratitude for more clinicians out there spreading good messages.
Thank you. And you too. We're in this together. Like, yes, all COVID stuff, we're in this together, but we're in the bigger picture together as well. The healthcare picture, and getting people to take control of their bodies. So thank you for continuing to pump stuff out, and I'm excited for this to launch.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to us on the Optimal Body Podcast, where we're going to continue to bring you the PT pearls and guests that will help you find your optimal body. Now, head over to wherever you listen to this and leave us an honest review, and head to docgenfit.com/podcast where you can find all the show notes.
Don't forget that we're going to give away a free month to someone who subscribes, leaves us an awesome review, and lets us know what they want to review on the next PT Pearl. So we'll be choosing that once a week to get into a free month of the Optimal Body membership.